Welcome to the Developer Tribe. It's good to have you here for episode 6 of season 2 as we unpack the practice and process of developers, educators and beyond. It's good to have you here, whether you are a seasoned listener or new to the pod. This really is a passion project for me that I gain so much from, so I can only hope that it is doing the same for you. Thanks for being here, however you got here. And with that, let's jump in. My guest today is, well, he's a lot of things, and it would be remiss of me to try to capture it all in this intro. Owner of Be More Learning and Development, he operates also as a mentor for UK Sport, and his previous roles as a coach developer with Sports Coach UK, England Athletics, British Cycling, British Shooting, and as a lecturer at Barnsley College. This huge experience belies impact. His tagline on LinkedIn is putting myself in places to be found, and indeed, that is where I found him and left an initial conversation feeling the better for it. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Kurt Lindley to the pod.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, sir. And that is probably one of the nicest introductions I've probably had, so it doesn't make me feel at all. Well, thanks for putting things like Barnsley College as well.
I went all the way back through. What's going on for you?
Pandemic, I suppose, like most people will be saying in this context, but I think it's we talked just about off screen there, and actually it's probably worth bringing it in. Like, you sometimes can be really productive in an hour where you nail loads of work, and I think I have to be very kind of clever with my time. So at the moment I'm homeschooling and parent till midday, and then I'm having to smash work until my daughter's kind of ready to come back to my world. So it's about, right now, it's about productivity and efficiency and looking after yourself in that space to make sure you can keep working well.
Yeah, tough to balance, and not something I envy or have to deal with myself. So more power to you. That's some resume I've just gone through. Take us through the journey if you can.
The journey, you know, these journeys, when you take some time to really reflect, if you're honest, they start when you're a child. And I've never really kind of realised that until a couple of years ago. But I was South African born, moved to the UK. So, well, before we moved to the UK, I have to acknowledge that I was born into apartheid. So I lived in a country where there was separateness, and I had no idea why this was the case. I wasn't able or intelligent enough as a six-year-old to kind of understand the context I was living in. I moved here to the UK when I was 7, and then I moved into a little mining town called Goldthorpe, and it was a very different separateness. So it was 1985, just at the end of the miner strikes, and there were those that worked in the pits and there were those that didn't, and neither side spoke in a nice way to each other on the whole. So you would have people walking on opposite sides of the street for a different reason. So those kind of formative years really kind of, I suppose, have stuck with me in terms of choosing to try and understand why. Like, why do people make choices? Why do people like people without knowing fully all they need to know about them? Why do people dislike people without understanding who they are, their perspective, their point of view? You know, why do we sometimes create an echo chamber for ourselves? Because maybe we feel it fulfills, you know, who we want to be and who we are by reinforcing that message, versus those who choose deliberately to walk in the shoes or in the paths of people quite different to them and find that a more growing experience. So, yeah, my journey, when I think about it, probably started back then, continuing with a question of why. Like, why is it this way? You know, why is that bully doing that thing? How does he think that's going to change the world? Why is that person choosing that path? How do they, you know, what sits behind that? And then there's a series of traumas that I think happened in my early years that didn't pop up that often. But I lost my father when I was 13. And it was a very difficult situation to kind of deal with as a 13-year-old in a mining town. It's not a conversation that people have around wellness and mental health and stuff like that. And, you know, I think I was lucky enough in the same year to meet my wife. Yes, at 13, I met my wife. That, I suppose, gave me faith to deal with what that year was like, you know, 13 to 14, and how how we envisage the future and how people around us can be a real benefit to us at such a young age. Now, she didn't really like me when I was 13, my wife, and we didn't really connect until I was about 20. But yeah, at 13, I met my wife, and at 20, we were in a relationship. And a number of years later, probably something like 12, I think, 12 years later, we got married. In that, I met somebody who taught me a lesson every day, and that was about kind of choosing you. And getting better at choosing you, choosing to know who you are, choosing to like who you are, and choosing to find spaces where you can be who you are. And I suppose then my jobs that I did along the way were just in relation to that. You know, the work I did it allow me to be me? If not, I moved on. Did the work grow me and grow the people around me? If not, I moved on. So I probably had my greatest tenure at what was Sports Coach UK, now UK Coaching, 11 years. And I would say it was like a, you know, it was a schooling, you know, it was a place to kind of learn your craft. And I'm grateful for what it gave me. And I'm grateful for how it treated me through other difficult situations. So we'll get the next kind of like trauma out of the way. But yeah, I sadly lost my wife now 5 years ago. And the company, which was UK Coaching, cared for me dearly during that trauma period, which allowed me to kind of like gather myself and think about the future, which is about this now. Putting yourself in places to be found and using every day as a teaching experience and finding the lessons in the dark and finding the optimism alongside the reality. So there's some harsh realities in life, but it's okay to have optimism as well. Not sure if that is the entirety of what you were looking for, and I'm not sure if it completely answered the question, but it's the thing I probably wanted to say.
No, and absolutely thank you for saying it. You know, I love hearing about the journeys of the speakers that come onto the Developer Tribe, because it has an impact on who we are as people, and therefore who we are as developers, and who you were as working at UK Sport, what you do now. It has an impact. So look, firstly, obviously condolences for your losses, but you're really open about those. And when we spoke initially, you directed me to a couple of videos that, you know, you've spoken about it in poetic terms. You've used various ways to open up about it, and that can be a really, really tough thing to do. What drove you to do that, and what impact did it have?
So if I've learned anything in life, it's like there isn't a right sometimes, and there isn't a wrong. There's just an impact of your actions. So there's been a drive to kind of continue to understand the impact of my actions or lack of action. And at times I've had a conversation with myself for too long, and it's time to have that conversation with somebody else. And you don't know if anybody's going to listen, and you don't know if anybody's going to talk back. So when I lost my wife, a message that she gave me was that you're not going to do this on your own. Yeah, you know, in the nicest possible way, she was just saying, you're not going to make this journey on your own. So what you need to do is reach out. You need to reach out and ask for help, and you need to accept help when it's given. And part of that reaching out is about telling your story. And I'm not telling it from a point of view of woe is me, and I'm not telling it from a point of view of my life is difficult, and I'm not telling it from a point of view of I've got it harder than you. I'm telling it from a point of view of this is my life. This is the lesson that it has taught me. And this is what I'm doing with it. And it may not be simply to transmit, i.e. I'm transmitting something and I want you to get a lesson from it. It may be self-fulfilling. Like, I have chosen to do some of these acts because they help me. So I blog, I've got a magazine, I've done a TEDx Doncaster talk, and I do poetry. And expressing myself through these mediums and telling the story that I feel that is in my head that can be shared is so healthy for like movement and for learning and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it may be useful to others, but it's often its intention is it's useful to me. So why not do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had an awesome experience in Saudi Arabia where Andy Vassily, a good friend of mine, offered me the chance to step up and to speak about the loss of my mother. And it was the first time that I'd done that, even though it'd been, you know, a number of years. And just going through that process of, well, what did I want to say? What did I want to impart on other? What actually was important? How do I want this story, for want of a better word, to portray itself? And it made a big difference in the shift into a more positive space, as to actually this had a really big impact on my life, both positively and negatively. What does this now mean for me? And how do I react to situations where I'm speaking with people and they've had similar experiences or not had similar experiences? So the question I would want to ask here is, with all of your experience within sport, within development, and then the way in which you have unpacked all of your personal experiences, how aware are you of those things when you then work with someone new or in a situation that is new?
I think my greatest weakness, and I work on it every time I meet new people, and I think it's a lot of us, is assumptions. You know, we too quickly can make assumptions about a situation, a context, a person's experience, based on, you know, their gender, their age, their colour, what you've heard about their CV, whatever it is. And I think, don't. You know, stereotypes and first impressions and assumptions are valuable in a sense that they are information. But you can only see them as information. You cannot see them as fact or truths until you've checked them. So, you know, one of the things I work on is not making too many assumptions. And those that I make is ensuring that I check the validity of them. Otherwise, you can, and I've made some mistakes in my early days. I remember a session that I was delivering probably eight or 9 years ago, getting really scratching the surface of emotion with people in a room where I'd made an assumption the people in the room had a kinship and a caring and a love for each other. And I took people in the room to a space that was perhaps more vulnerable than they needed to go. Now, that was me creating the space for it to occur. And an individual couldn't manage themselves in that space and left the room. And the most kind of like shock kind of experience for myself was no one left with her, no one left to follow. And I stood there wondering, wow, A, what have I done here? And should I have gone here? You know, B, what happens next? And then the personal shock of, oh my God, have I overstepped my mark? Now, at that point, I kind of paused the session, gave people something to contemplate while I left and found where this person was. And we literally spent the next 45 minutes repairing a relationship and building a shared understanding for the trauma that we both shared. We had a similar story. And I had no idea how my story was affecting her, but it was so raw because her family friend was in a very dark situation. So I'd made the wrong assumption about that context and that group of people and that individual. And I've learned from then and many other sessions that, you know, you've got to kind of manage the situations that you work in carefully. And that's about understanding what is actually there in front of you, listening and being present, and probably listening beyond the words and beyond the actions. There are tones and intonation, and there are small leakages of information that are really valuable to you. And it's that stuff that you need to be paying attention to, rather than simply going through a process of trying to share something or teach something.
It's a really valuable answer. A couple of things came to mind as you were speaking there. That I spoke with Aidan O'Sullivan in the previous season of this podcast, where he was talking about cold reading and how much information you can get off a person without actually having engaged with them yet. And how important that information can be. In my reflection on that conversation, I thought about how we move from cold reading to something more warm, for want of a better analogy, but something warm in which it's a closer relationship there. And it sounds a little bit like the experience you've had with that person having to leave the room, and then, as you say, repair the relationship. I want to bounce this off you because this is something that I've been thinking about for a while, and you're the right person to ask. Clearly, we bring our own biographies with us to any environment that we're in. And I think as a coach developer or a person developer, we have to be aware of what we're bringing to the party. Is it the biography that we're dealing with when we're working with people, or is it the narrative in which they speak of their biography?
Depends how truthful they are about their world, I suppose, and how aware they are. You know, we've got that point of how much do I know myself, so can I articulate it? versus I'm self-reporting, I'm afraid to articulate all of it, so I'll give a different version of myself. And you know, can we ever really truly know that what we're hearing is either the pure honesty or the pure honesty alongside of the full awareness of ourselves? I think this is where you don't know. And you can question yourself to the nth degree, and you can question the people you're working with to the nth degree. Or you can trust your instincts. You know, they are informed by years and years of experience. And as long as the bias doesn't play too strong a kind of influence on that, but you choose to trust your innate, whatever's happening within you, and go with it. The only thing you can do there is choose positive intent and act in the right manner that you believe to be right, knowing that if you're wrong, you did it from the good place, and they hopefully have seen it. It's come from the good place, and therefore it's easier to repair rather than missing an opportunity. You know, I think when we have done some obviously mentoring training through UK Sport, and a gentleman called Sam Whale used to talk about, you know, open doors, and where you're having a conversation with somebody and they open a door. And you've got to make a decision as to whether it's safe to go into that room. You know, there are some times where it's safe to open that door and carry on the conversation because the environment you set is correct and whatever's going to be shared, disclosed, can be managed. And other times it's better to walk past that door. How do you know? And that's where you have to kind of listen really into the experience and the environment and choose to trust your instincts, knowing that you might get it wrong. But if you did, it's from positive intent.
I'm soaking that one up. I wanted to leave it a little moment just to absorb it. It sounds a little bit similar to some of the academic literature and theory around talent needs trauma, which is something I can't quite get my head around properly yet. I prefer to use, and people have heard me talk about this before, I prefer to use the term troublemaking, but I haven't really fully unpacked what I mean by that yet. But what you're talking about there of, are we creating an environment where we can cause a disjuncture? We can cause, perhaps using the word trauma carefully, without it being so difficult that actually they can't engage that moment anymore. They can't engage what the development might look like in that space. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, like you can go one step too far into that room when people are not ready to manage it. And that's not to say that you shouldn't tackle some of the issues that you're faced with. You know, people being upset or uncomfortable or facing a truth is not a bad thing. The bad thing is if you've set it up badly, if you've not created the environment for people to acknowledge that this might happen, and there is no follow-on care in terms of, okay, how do we manage when we finish this meeting? If it's virtual, I come off the call, what happens to you? You know, if we do it physically, we move away from this physical space. Where do you go? What do you do? You know, if we've not managed the intro and exit from that space, that's where, you know, like our good practice kind of like really needs to kick in. And, you know, I've heard it before, you know, talent needs trauma. And it's not that I would agree or disagree with it. I get it. I totally understand it. So I don't think I'd be the person I am today had I not had trauma, both as a young person at 13 and younger with other things and as a young adult as well. But it wasn't the trauma that created who I am. It's how I was cared for by my nurturing environment during those periods and beyond. So you'll find if you look at, for example, people with learning difficulties, if they live and work and go to school in a nurturing environment, they will generally excel in some way because they are cared for because and with the challenges that they have. So for example, dyslexia can often be seen as somebody who struggles to read and write, but actually it's a processing thing. Now, when people understand it's a processing thing, they have more time and care for you as an individual because they understand it will take you a little bit longer to get to where you want to get to. And your language might not meet with the listener's ear. So they work with you on that. And you will struggle as a dyslexic, let's say, in early years on a daily basis. So you have trauma every day. Every time somebody puts a piece of paper in front of you with some words on and asks you to speak, that's trauma. If you're nurtured, you can manage that trauma so that when bigger traumas appear, like the loss of my father, maybe I can cope with it better because I've had a lot of smaller traumas along the route. but I was cared for in that. Now, if you look at the alternative, my diagnosis isn't noticed, isn't cared for. I don't live in a nurturing family, and I live in a school that's overpopulated. So there's too many kids in a classroom for the teacher to pay attention to me. Or I'm in a coaching context, the same thing. There's too many coaches and none of coach developers. It's not noticed and not cared for. I feel like I'm not understood. I might join the tribe that is less savory, and I might take part in acts that are less socially acceptable, and I might find myself taking a different path. So both people had trauma, but one was nurtured and one was not. And I think it's about that. It's about nurture through the experience of trauma.
It's a really important point, but I got to push a little bit more here. That we, you know, what does that nurture look like, and how much responsibility does the individual take over accessing that nurture?
Again, I think there's not a straight line here. You can take a horse to water, but they may not drink, sort of scenario. I'd love to give an answer that would answer things, but we see it now in our communities where there are support services there, but people not accessing. Well, why are they not accessing? Well, because it's socially within their context seen as a weakness to access that resource. Okay, so we need to relabel it and rename it, call it something else, so it becomes more palatable. I heard a story the other day. If you have two. And this is directly from a person who works in the building trade. So I'm going to relay their story so I don't get done for saying this story. If you have two builders, let's say two tradesmen in the front of a van, and listen to the conversation that happens with two, and then you have three people in the front of the van, what does that conversation change to? And the inference was that when there's two people, they're more likely to have the less manly man conversation and the more disclosure pieces over time as they get to know and know that it's shared between those two. You add a third person in and they may revert to type, which might be what's socially acceptable based on our biographies and what our trade perceives as normal behavior. And you can see the same in a coaching context. You know, I think in a coaching context, there is a perception that coaches need to know everything or need to know a great deal. They need to be the expert. They need to be seen as infallible, you know, not flawed in any way. So if that is the context that I've moved into and I'm a young coach moving through the system, when do I have the courage to say I don't know? And how do I raise my hand in a forum where I'm with other people that have 10, 15, 20 years experience across multiple disciplines and they know their stuff? You know, who's nurturing me and inviting me to speak and making it safe for me to say something? Yeah, so we did some research years ago now, but with talented coaches and their mentors, and we talked about what was the importance between the relationships. And what we realized in that conversation was when we had mentors working with coaches that were in a different sport, the relationship was far more enriched and growth-based because the coaches would disclose that they didn't feel assessed in any way by this external person because they didn't know their world, so they didn't know if they were getting it right or wrong. So they were happier to disclose when they didn't know something. But as soon as a mentor from their own sport came along, I'm not saying the relationship was better or worse, it was different. And it was different sometimes because of the gravitas of this other person coming in and how it may have made some of the coaches feel around inferiority or fear to disclose. So it's not one's bad or one's good. They do different things. But the reality is when we use outside of our context support, that's when we may grow more because we're more open and we do disclose more and we more choose to move forward rather than step back and wait or pretend we know everything when we don't.
Yeah. And very often my experiences of coach education myself or as a coach educator, there is that moment usually at the beginning of a course where some form of, hey, I don't know all the answers has to happen. And I was having an interesting discussion with Russell Earnshaw over this about where it's possible that it's because you're wearing the kit, you're in a classroom situation, they've walked through the door after you've already been there, the classroom set out a certain way, all of this symbolic stuff that's going on. And actually, as coach educators, we feel like we have to mediate that straight away. by saying, you know, there's more knowledge looking towards me than there is me looking towards you. I feel like perhaps we could do a better job of removing some of that symbolic power in the first place. And that's kind of what you're describing in terms of maybe some mentoring relationships where there is a distance between the mentor and the mentee's actual in situ context. But I suspect that potentially the best form of coach ed could be a combination of formal, informal, and then a network of people who have a different set of distance away from the context that that person works in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where, you know, a learner coach developer can choose to create that tapestry themselves. You know, if they're clever, they can put themselves in places to be found. They can attract people towards them, and they can create the right dialogue with a mix of people inside and outside of the sport. So when I left the sporting world, let's say, in terms of a formal job, so my last formal role was as the people development manager at British Shooting. And when I left that space, I made a clear decision to say, I need to wrap around me people from outside of sport for me to grow. So I continued to have the sporting fraternity to look to for guidance and support. And we have WhatsApp groups, and we have, like, you know, workshoppy conversations and stuff like that. But equally, I've added to my support team, my tribe, if you want to use your words, a collection of leaders from the education world, so from schools. So those who are on a daily basis right now are dealing with challenges that they've never, ever encountered. I'm getting a great deal of teaching from that and how I can use that elsewhere. But equally from business, where sometimes the bottom line is money, not people, and some difficult choices are made. So what am I learning from that context? And bringing those three kind of worlds together gives you a better understanding about the risks that we have, the decisions we can make, the growth that we can have. Now, I've chosen that. I've gone out and chosen that. I'm a hungry learner. Why? Because I get bored if I'm not learning. So that's me choosing to entertain my own mind. Maybe I can't relax, and that's what I do instead of relaxing. That's not easy for everybody, particularly if you're an introvert as well. You're not somebody who chooses to speak out and ask for support and guidance. But equally, we can create a system that can give some of that. It would become more expensive. But then the learner might need to pay for that in some way. We need to take that responsibility. That really good quality learning costs money, even if that's an hour with a quality developer rather than a course or a program. So I think the system can do well to surround coaches and coach developers with people beyond the sport, and not from a keynote sort of speak at a conference or not from a one-off workshop. I'm talking about ongoing in-situ relationships or ongoing contextualized conversations, you know. So this is what we do in a business world. How do we apply it to your world in sport, rather than here's what we do in a business world, you just go away and work on it, sort of thing. So I think, you know, there is some responsibility of the learner to search out these experiences as much as the system can create them.
No, I'm fully on board. I'm going to push you for an example. So whether that's from, you know, the education people you're speaking to, whether it's business related, something where you've taken something in learning and applied it to the coaching world, or indeed your own personal world?
I think the easiest one is to come out of the coaching world and into business, for example. So a great conversation that we started to have a few years ago was we annual plan. We annual plan the shit out of stuff, you know, in sport. We will look at intensity, volume, we will look at the sports science, the psych, you know, when we're developing routines around imagery, all that sort of stuff. We're planning where we're putting it in a day, in a week, in a month, and knowing when to change things based on injury or changes in competition calendars or changes in performance in our athletes. But we also know in that periodization of people's years, we have times when we are resting, and we have times when we are learning, and we have times when we are building and growing. Now, if you look at the business world, there's 52 weeks in a year. You might be lucky to get 2 to 4 weeks off. You know, 21 days is kind of the average. So 4 weeks, let's say, you get off. And the rest of the time, I need you to be nailing it. 9 to 5 every day, come in. Now, I don't think that's possible. And I don't think business has taken enough consideration for their employees and looking at them through the lens of an athlete. So I often ask people to say, I want to annualize your year. Like, where is your highest intensity? where is your highest volume? And let's look at where the dips are. Are you all having a dip at the same time? So that's your learning period as a team. So you can build in some real new skill development. Or are you all peaking and having troughs at different times? Is that where you look out for each other? So if it's my time to be peaking, I need to be looking around and know who's giving me some support and guidance, and they're low. So that's where we build the kind of idea of teamwork and collaboration. So I think it's at the moment, it's quite easy to take some awesome stuff from sport and play it into the business world. I think in the business world, playing it back is more about, you know, how much do you want this? You know, because if the business world doesn't work out, they lose money and they lose jobs and they lose their company. You know, and sometimes I think because of our funding system, and I'm not saying this for everybody, so please don't tie me with a brush saying everybody's like this, but because our jobs are paid for by a funding system and it's guaranteed for 4 years, let's say, we might become slightly complacent in our desire to be the best we can be and our desire to continue to be investing in our environment. So just before our redundancies at UK Coaching, my boss came along to me and he gave me a nudge and he said, and it wasn't about giving anything away. It was more about, do you believe that you are employable? And I said, what do you mean? He says, will people who you're working with today through working at UK Coaching, do you think they'll pay for your time if we had to charge you out? And I realized there and then, no. As much as I was doing a good job, as much as I thought coach education was going to be the bee's knees and I was going to deliver some great stuff around learning and teaching, no, I didn't think they'd pay £300, £400, £500 a day for my time whilst I was working there. They'd spend that elsewhere. Okay, so that says something about what I need to do to be the most employable, the most useful, the most able to contribute. So they do then desire to pay me. Now, if you translate that, I was made redundant and I am now a sole trader and I do run a business and people do pay me. So I must have done something right. But I think it was only because I was challenged on that question, which was, yeah, your time's paid for now. So people are getting you for free. So it's a great luxury for them. But are you good enough to be paid for it? You know, and that's something, you know, about our own development again that we need to kind of look into.
And again, the balance you were speaking about before of obviously it's on us to be as good as we can be as developers, but also that perhaps within sport, I don't know enough of the landscape. You can put me wrong here. Or put me right, the landscape of sport has been such for coaches for quite a long time that a lot has been provided to them for free. And perhaps we're looking at a situation now with the pandemic and various other constraints that might not be possible to provide to coaches in the same way anymore. So there feels to me like there's a bit of a hangover at the moment that you know, there's webinars available, there's coach development podcasts like this. There's, you know, you could wake up, start consuming it, and then go to sleep every day for months. And it's wonderful that all of that information is out there. But I'm getting the sense that coaches aren't quite clear on actually what does my pathway look like anymore.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the question there is, but I'm going to take us in a path that, again, maybe I just want to say this out loud. Learning is everywhere. Like, I really struggle where people say, you need to pay for me to go on this course. I said, well, I can buy you all the books secondhand that are related to that course. You read those and you talk to me about what you've learned from reading them. If you want an experience, I can introduce you to some people that can give you that experience, but you need to be kind of valuable to them in a way that they'll let you come into that space. So I think most courses that are available, that learning exists in multiple forms, in multiple ways. We've just got to search it out and look for it. So there is shed loads out there right now for free. Like, you know, like you say, your previous season of podcasts, it's not necessarily just about listening to it. It's about going, what resonated with me in that? What am I going to do with that learning? Am I brave enough to contact the speaker on that podcast? Can I create a way that they want to speak back to me? Can I get an hour with them that they're going to share their insight that they didn't share on the podcast that's going to help me sense make? That's possible. You know, and actually some of your speakers on previous podcasts would have enjoyed being contacted in that way because they believe people are listening to them. So I think there is that around kind of entitlement, like, you know, I need to be put on this next level of course and I need to be put on this next level of thing. The negative there is then around kind of like this credibility comes with a badge. And it's sad, but it's a fact. You know, I got a master's in psychology. Some of it was around wanting to test myself, but some of it was definitely around once I have a master's, people will talk to me differently. They will listen to me differently because they have a perception that I know what I'm talking about. The reality is I remembered what I needed to remember the moment before the 3-hour exam started, and I forgot it 15 minutes later. The rest of the stuff that's in my head has come from conversations and experience. So I have a master's in psychology that gives me some level of credibility. But the reality is I probably remember 5% of it. And that's only because it was interesting, not because it was the right stuff.
Yeah. And look, I've experienced very similar. Talking about that credibility then, and I wanted to find a way to shoehorn this in. So we've got there. You know, in the intro, I gave that list of your experience. I think it would be fair to say, Kurt, and you can put me wrong here, that presumably you're not a high performance athlete, cyclist, shooter, and everything else that you've worked in. So we've spoken about some of the distance away from the in situ performance of a coach. In those places you were working, were you working with athletes as well?
Predominantly with coaches. Okay. Just to get that right, I was probably mediocre or less than mediocre, all of those things that you listed. But that didn't mean I didn't have an innate interest into the human mind and the human body. You know, my first interest was sports science and really looking at the nitty-gritty of anatomy and physiology and, you know, performance enhancement through physical difference. You know, like the whole idea of when a cycling, you know, you change the dimensions of a bike by small amounts and you change the drag through the wind tunnel that you might see, and you change then suddenly the time that somebody might get on a track. Wow, that's amazing. But there's a finite number of jobs that allow you to do that. So I went down the route of, like, you know, human development, you know, and the reality there is, no matter what industry you're in, what job you're doing, the connecting piece is we are human. And the better we are able to understand who we are, our frailties as well as our strengths, and be happy with that, or find a way to become happier with who we are, then working in that space, that's you know, that's where the master's in psychology played its kind of part. It was like, how do I understand human behavior? Because, you know, currently I work with executives and chief executives for large companies that I have no idea how that company runs. But what I do is create a space for a conversation that they need to have that they're not getting elsewhere. It's amazing that you get paid for that. It's a little bit sad as well that maybe our community as a whole, our society as a whole, doesn't create natural spaces for that. And some of that's about fear of speaking out, but some of that is maybe the people we're speaking to is too much of a pub conversation rather than a developmental one. That doesn't need to go anywhere. It might just need to explore something. You know, we sometimes can get trapped in that. As a consequence of this session, you need to have led to an outcome. Sometimes the outcome is just we explored it to a point that we better understood it, rather than we're going to take an action now, or we're better at something because.
And indeed, the outcomes might be different for each individual that's engaged with that, and might be outcomes that we had no idea of or couldn't have guessed at. I want to again push a bit further. So, say, take British Shooting as an example. You know, your involvement with them. Presumably, there were some tensions when you started between yourself and the coaches of that sport in terms of, is this person going to credibly impact positively our work? Did you have any experiences like that, and how did you get over it?
I think you picked the place where I probably made some of the biggest mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully there weren't huge mistakes, but there were definitely mistakes. And you can talk to my line manager, you know, you can talk to Steve Seligman, who was the PD there, and they'll tell you mistakes that I made and things that I probably should have noticed and seen. You know, Dean Leake as well would give you kind of some insight. I think probably more to tell you about lessons. Yes, don't go in assuming. I went in assuming that I knew more, not than other people, but I knew how to solve this. And that was part of the biggest problem, is that I was trying to solve something that wasn't mine to solve. It was other people's to manage and work with. And we need to recognize in some of those spaces, credibility through working in the sport is powerful. I had no prior knowledge of working in the sport. I had no experience other than mentoring the head coach previously. I had no understanding of the sport. So I probably jumped too far ahead in trying to influence change, not make change, but influence change before building a strong enough relationship or platform from which to do that. So, you know, to anybody else entering into an environment that doesn't look like theirs or isn't where they don't have natural credibility, I would say, you know, you need to have a parallel way of working. One of building a foundation, a platform of a relationship that is strong and that if rocked, you can still stand upon and it will come with you. The people will go with you. But at the same time, delivering something that is meaningful to that audience. And this is, again, where you might need to play with what people need and hiding that within what people want. Because we know people turn up to concerts and gigs or events where they want something. It might not necessarily be anything to do with what they need, but they won't always turn up to things that are needed and important. So again, whenever you're building an experience, is to understand what are you filtering in the exciting stuff. So the exciting stuff is drawing people to it. It's making them attend to the learning. But it's beyond that. What are you creating that is helping them think differently? Some of our greatest epiphanies come from when we realized we were wrong. So how do we get people to accept or be comfortable to go, now you've just said that, I have changed my view and I believe something new, or I have a new way of seeing the world. I just rushed ahead. And I don't think I lost any friendships. I just think I created more tension than I actually needed to create. And I could have been a little bit more subtle and slower, which is hard to do when you're working in a performance environment where we need change sometimes quickly. And there's that tension that you're playing in. Sometimes you get it wrong.
There's a lot to unpick there. It reminds me of, I tried to read a book by Edward de Bono many years ago and failed miserably. But the title of it was I'm Right, You're Wrong. And from what I can tell, the idea of it was that the way language has been built, particularly around law and legal language, it was designed to create a situation where we are able to tell one person is right, one person is wrong. And as a result of that, it's very difficult to, within language, create these spaces where it's possible to be fallible. It's possible to hold nuanced positions. It's possible to say it with a genuine vulnerability, this might not be right, but hey, what do you think about it? And unfortunately, very often in the coaching space, and we see it even on, you know, social media versions of the coaching space, that very often this is still playing out. And I just wonder as to how positive, how useful an experience that actually is for us.
I think so. Most successful organizations, I think you might refer to them as learning organizations. They adopt an approach sometimes where there is the authenticity or vulnerability to advocate your position, but be open to influence. You know, so, you know, this is what I believe, but I'm yet to trust that opinion wholeheartedly in a way that if you shared something new with me, it might change my opinion. So I've got to be open to the influence of new information. And it was Tom Whitaker, who's at powerlifting, British weightlifting. He introduced me to something called the dishonest argument. And I want to kind of paraphrase, so I might not get this totally right, but it's about, we start an argument with our perception maybe that we're right. And there's a point at which during that argument, we realize we may no longer be right. Can we be honest about it? Or do we continue to overemphasize our position to try and prove that we're right? Now we're in a dishonest argument at that point. And the reality is most of us have those regularly. And there is no winner there, because even if we win the argument, yes, well done. But what we've done is we've created a deficit. I've probably lost the relationship. I've got to repair that relationship. And that success of being a winner is short-lived. It's like buying a nice outfit, wearing it once, and never getting a chance to wear it again. You go and buy another nice outfit. It's kind of like it's short-lived. So being right isn't always helpful. but understanding the opinion of others and having your opinion understood as well. So it's not about relinquishing all sense of control and saying, oh, no, it's all about balance and democracy. It isn't. It's about, I am taking the time to understand your perspective. I still don't always agree, but I have now taken the time to understand your perspective rather than, no, that's not right.
It's a really powerful place to end there, I think. If you don't mind, that is just so wonderfully put, and I will look forward to listening back to that to reflect on it. Last question for you. If you could have an audience with just one person, who would you choose?
I'd have to say my wife, mate. Nailed it. Yeah. What lesson have I missed? Like, what lesson can you teach me? So, you know, like, we can close it off before I talk this piece if needed, but I often relate to people in a sense of people sometimes when they listen to me talk, they think my wife is still here with me. And the reason they think that is because I talk about her. She teaches me a lesson pretty much every day. So my question to myself is often, you know, what's the lesson from today and what is the teaching? So I would be intrigued just to know, you know, what lessons do I still need to learn? Because she was that person that would always create a space for you to kind of grow and learn. So, yeah, I'd have that. I'd have an audience with my wife.
It feels very authentic and feels positive as well as a choice, Kurt. And, you know, appreciate you being as honest and candid as you have been all the way through this. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on. Kurt, thank you so much for your time today. If anyone did want to reach out, where would they find you, given that you put yourself in places?
Easiest place to find me is on Twitter, just at Coach Developer. Check me out, have a conversation. I'm on LinkedIn as well, and just Google Kurt Lindley and have a laugh at what you find. But yeah, just come and say hello. Don't be a stranger.
At Coach Developer, that is a prime tag to have there, isn't it? Well done for getting that handle. Thank you for your time again. A wonderful conversation that I've taken a lot from. So, you know, selfishly, a really big thank you to you. Just leaves me to say, welcome to the tribe.
Thank you, sir. I look forward to joining with other people.
Wow, what a beautiful conversation Kurt has offered to us today. This is one I know I will refer back to many times in the coming years to grab the learnings from again. The music you are listening to is by BB Phoenix. You can find her details in the links. If you haven't already, please do subscribe and leave feedback. The tribe is growing and in such a positive direction. Thanks for being here, however you got here, and we look forward to having you back here next week.